Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Great. Hi, everybody. It's Helen Burstyn at AQF. Thank you for joining our CSAC webinar today on risk adjustment for sociodemographic factors. I know we've got Christy Travis, one of our the vice chair with us, and I don't know if Frank has joined us yet. I know he's got dueling afternoon assignments, but he'll dial in as soon as he can. Maybe we'll just begin quickly with Steve running through roll call to see how many of the CSAC members have joined us yet, and we do know they frequently will join us in the next 10 minutes or so. Go ahead, Steve.
Sure. Andrew Baskin. William Conway.
Present.
Okay. Robert Ellis.
Here.
Lee Flesher.
Hi.
Hi. David Dalton.
Here.
Thank you. Philip Mailer.
Here.
Ann Monroe.
Here.
Arden Morris. I think he said he will be late. Lynn Padgett.
Here.
Carolyn Perry.
Yep, I'm here.
Thank you. Lynn Partridge.
Hi.
Lee Partridge. Sorry.
I'm here.
Tina Free. Okay. David Roof. And Dana Saffron. I'm done with the roll call. Thank you, everyone.
Great. Wonderful. So at this point, I'm going to turn things over to Christy to start the discussion, and then we'll introduce our committee co-chairs and Karen, who will lead us through the slide deck. Christy?
Thank you, Helen. I won't take very much time at the very beginning, but to welcome everybody. And I want to really give a big thank you to the co-chairs of the expert panel, which have joined us today, as well as to the staff of NQF and to the expert panel itself. This is a very complex issue, and our real purpose today for the CSAC is to get acquainted with what the panel has been wrestling with, to understand their current thinking, their recommendations. We are very open and free to give our opinions, our input, and our feedback, and also to be sure that we ask clarifying questions so that we can understand the rationale of the expert panel. Just as a reminder that we will get this back again someday in a formal view for the CSAC after it goes through public comment and after the expert panel is able to consider the comments that have been received and make any changes or revisions to their report, they will give us a final report with their final set of recommendations. The CSAC at that point will take a formal vote whether or not we accept the report and the changes that may be included in the report that would change the evaluation criteria. So this is a great opportunity for us as a CSAC to get an early view of the thinking that is surrounding this very complex yet very important issue. And so please feel free to fully engage today. And for us to be sure that we have the opportunity to learn from each other what the issues are, as well as from the expert panel and our team at NQF. Great. So with that, I think I would like to turn it back to Helen, who is going to introduce our co-chairs, and they will then begin to talk about the process that has been used and gone through to date, as well as the recommendations. And then we will be opening it up for questions and answers and discussion after that. So, Helen, I'll turn it back to you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Christy. And special thanks to Christy and Frank, who had a conversation with us a couple of days ago. So we were able to tee up some specific discussion questions that the chairs will walk through this presentation. But, again, we're very open to others from other CSEC members as well. So next slide, please. So we are delighted today to have the co-chairs of our expert panel with us, actually both of them. Kevin Fisella is a professor of family medicine, public health, community health at University of Rochester. He is very well known to many of us in the disparities community for his extensive work on disparities as well as practical strategies to reduce disparities. Dave Nerens as well, another very well-respected person in the world of health policy and disparities, is director of the Center for Health Policy and Health Services Research at Henry Ford. He's also a commissioner of MedPAC, which, as you know, has wrestled with this issue as well, and he was also recently chair of the IOM Subcommittee on Standardized Collection of Race and Ethnicity Data for Healthcare Quality Improvement. So with this, I'm going to turn it over to, I'm not sure who's leading us off. Karen, wonderful.
Karen.
All right. So good afternoon, everyone. It's Karen Pace, and I've been working with the staff, with the expert panel and the other staff involved in this project. So we just quickly put up a list of the expert panel members. This has been a very engaged and active panel with a lot of good expertise and experience to work on this topic. Next slide. So I'm going to just give you a brief introduction to the project and then turn it over to our co-chairs. But the purpose of this project was to identify and examine the issues related to risk-adjusting outcome performance measures for socioeconomic status or other sociodemographic factors, and to make recommendations regarding if, when, for what, and how the measures should be adjusted for sociodemographic factors, and make recommendations related to NQF's endorsement criteria. Also, just to note, during this project, the expert panel identified that process performance measures also may need adjustment, and we can get into that later, but we'll focus primarily on outcome measures. Next slide. So it's also important to note that the project did not include recommendations on specific performance measures, though we often talked about measures as examples and illustrations. It's not about how to determine payment for services, such as capitated payments, so obviously related issues. It was not intended to make recommendations about use of a particular risk model or statistical model, and it was not intended to make recommendations about structuring performance reward and penalty programs. So, you know, we were very focused on the performance measurement aspect. Next slide. Just to couple of key points, and we'll be talking about these throughout this project, but basically, patient sociodemographic factors influence outcomes through a variety of pathways. There's a substantial body of evidence about this, about various outcomes and also various sociodemographic factors. The other thing that is challenging related to this project is that sociodemographic factors may also be related to disparities in health and healthcare. And again, just to make sure we're on the same page, we are using the term sociodemographic as a broader term that includes socioeconomic status, which are typically income, education, and occupation, as well as other demographic factors, which could be age, race, ethnicity, primary language, and other things such as homelessness. Next slide. As we went into this project, we knew that there were at least two divergent views, and one is that adjusting for sociodemographic factors will mask disparities or imply that there should be different standards. And the other view is that adjusting for sociodemographic factors is necessary for making correct inferences about quality. And again, as we go through our project information, we'll be addressing these more as we go through. Next slide. The other thing that I'm going to touch on here is just definitions, because it's one of the things that our expert panel grappled with, and we finally decided that we needed to really clearly define some things and identify differences. So we're using the term risk adjustment to refer to the statistical methods to control or account for patient-related factors when computing performance scores. We sees stratification as something separate, and this involves computing performance scores separately for different strata so that each provider would have multiple performance scores, one for each stratum rather than one overall performance score. And then a third method that we looked at was peer groups for comparison, and this is creating peer groups of providers that are caring for a similar mix of patients within which to examine performance scores. And the example of this that we've been talking about is the MedPAC recommendation. This next slide is the current relevant existing NQF criteria, and it's cited in criterion 2B4, and basically says that for outcome measures and other measures when indicated, such as resource use, that they an evidence-based risk-adjusted strategy would be specified. It should be based on patient factors that influence the measured outcome, but we say should not be factors related to disparities in care. And we have a note to that particular sub-criterion, note 15, that goes on to say that it's preferable to stratify measures by race and socioeconomic status. So that was the existing NQF criteria, and one of the things that definitely would be impacted by the expert panel's recommendations. So from there, I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Sucella.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is Kevin. I hope everybody can hear me.
Fine, Kevin.
I very much appreciate this opportunity to really walk through our thinking and deliberations regarding this complex topic. When we first embarked on this topic, we anticipated that there would be divergent perspectives on the committee, and so we thought that the best way to begin was to agree on a set of core principles. These have been enumerated. The first is that outcome performance measurement is critical to the aims of the national quality strategy. I think most will agree with that. The second and important point was that disparities in health and healthcare should be identified and reduced. The third is that performance measurement should not lead to an increase in disparities in health and healthcare. The fourth was that outcomes may be influenced by both patient health status, clinical, and sociodemographic factors, in addition to the quality and effectiveness of the healthcare services, treatment, and interventions that are being delivered. Next slide, please. So the fifth principle is when used in accountability applications, performance measures that are influenced by factors other than the care received, particularly for outcome measures, these need to be adjusted for relevant differences in case mix to avoid incorrect inferences about performance. The sixth principle was that risk adjustment may be constrained by existing data limitations as well as the burden associated with collecting of those data. And the seventh principle is that the methods, factors, and rationale for risk adjustment should be transparent to all. Next slide, please. So as Karen alluded to in her slide set, there's sort of competing concerns on both sides. So on one side, we have a concern that some providers may deliver worse quality care to disadvantaged patients, and that corresponding adjustment might make meaningful differences in quality, quote, disappear. And as a result, this could result in diminished expectation for improvement, particularly among disadvantaged patients. As well as establishing the potential for a dual system of care, in other words, a set of a different standard of care for patients based on these socio-demographic characteristics. Next slide, please. The counterbalancing of this concern was the concern with unintended consequences for not considering socio-demographic factors in adjusting performance scores. And I think first and foremost was a concern regarding an erroneous inference about quality. So just as clinical measures can affect quality, associated demographic factors, particularly those related to access constraints and adherence constraints, could certainly affect quality, just like clinical factors can. And in the context of public reporting of performance and pay for performance, this could potentially make healthcare disparities worse. And there was a long discussion about different mechanisms. One is that providers could have an incentive to avoid serving disadvantaged patients. In other words, if they perceive disadvantaged patients as lowering their scores, they might avoid serving these patients for fear of being labeled a bad performer. And, of course, we've seen this happen in other instances. Substantial amounts of money will be shifted away from organizations serving disadvantaged populations and communities to those serving more affluent, less vulnerable populations and communities. In other words, if there's pay for performance and that there is, in essence, a bias that's introduced by failing to account for the socio-demographic factors, that this would disadvantage those serving disadvantaged patient populations, particularly safety net hospitals, health plans, and other provider groups. And third, individual patients and consumers, private and public payers, and others who are choosing among providers based on these performance metrics will tend to avoid providers serving disadvantaged patients and communities. In other words, for example, patients might make erroneous decisions based on measures that have not accounted for these factors. Others might make contracting decisions. So all of these could result in reduced resources flowing to safety net providers. Next slide, please. So, as Karen alluded, we grappled with the question of does adjustment mask disparities or meaningful differences in quality. In other words, if one includes factors related to disadvantage, socio-demographic factors, particularly those related to SES, in these statistical models, would this actually mask disparities and minimize differences in quality in a meaningful way? Does adjustment create, in essence, dual standards of care? And are socio-demographic factors different than clinical or health factors that are currently included in these models? If not, should the same principles for selecting risk factors apply? And if so, should there be a difference in terms of how to apply these various factors? Next slide, please. So the committee developed a series of principles for selecting for really applying existing metrics that have applied to clinical risk factors to social or socio-demographic factors. And so the first is, you know, is there a clinical or conceptual model for the relationship between that factor and the outcome of interest that's the subject of that particular quality measure? Is there empiric association of that factor with the outcome of interest? is their variation in prevalence of the factor across the measured entities? Is this factor present at the start of care? Does it not primarily represent the quality of care provided, for example, the treatments or expertise of the staff itself, because we wouldn't want to be adjusted for that if that was the primary mechanism? Is it resistant to manipulation or gaming? Can accurate data be reliably and feasibly captured in order to be included? And does inclusion of that factor contribute a small amount of unique variation to the outcome? And does it potentially improve the risk model, including standard metrics such as discrimination and calibration for the model? And last, does it have face validity and acceptability, particularly to those being reported on? Next slide, please. So then we move on to the question of, does adjustment mask meaningful differences in quality? It's true that some providers may be less effective in caring for patients with complex clinical conditions, but this certainly holds. But yet this clinical complexity is not excluded from risk models. So in an analogous way, we recognize that some providers may be more skilled in working with socio-demographically disadvantaged patients, just as some people may be more effective in managing a patient with diabetes or in helping to plan for discharge of a patient with heart failure. Risk adjustment allows conclusions about quality, i.e. differences due to the quality of care provided rather than differences in pre-existing circumstances of patients. So an extreme example would be a patient who is homeless, who is being discharged, versus a more affluent patient who is being discharged. Even if the discharge team made arrangements for that homeless person to have temporary shelter, we know that the likelihood of readmission, and whether it was for heart failure or pneumonia, would likely be greater for that homeless person than that person, than the more affluent patient being discharged into a more stable home, often with other social support also present. A performance score alone, whether or not adjusted for socio-demographic factors, cannot identify disparities. So the point here is that even with existing measures, that do not include adjustment for socioeconomic related factors, these don't make disparities currently visible. One needs to take additional steps to do that. So whether there is adjustment or not adjustment, neither obviates the need for a separate approach through stratification. We need to analyze in relation to whatever that particular socio-demographic characteristic is. And the stratification has practical limitations for accountability applications that we can get on to, we can discuss later in the call. Next slide, please.
So I think this is where Dave is going to pick up.
Yes.
Okay, happy to do that. Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Kevin. Just before we do the overview of these specific recommendations, we wanted to make a couple of key points that are essentially cross-cutting across a number of the specific recommendations. And they're listed here on this slide. First of all, although our recommendations do speak favorably about risk adjustment for socio-demographic factors, we don't think we are in any way stepping away from a continued commitment to issues of disparities, meaning attention to them and efforts to reduce or eliminate them. We point out specifically that the analytic approach, including possible adjustment, should be related to the purpose of the analysis. So in situations where disparities are the primary focus, stratification of performance measures, meaning reporting for meaningful subgroups, is the way to go. It's what tells you about disparities, and the recommendations include that. But for a number of other purposes, actual adjustment, according to the definition Karen gave earlier, is preferred, and that, again, is driven largely by this consideration about truly accurate measures of quality. We also want to emphasize that the positive recommendations that are made are not unconditional. We are not saying that all measures should be adjusted by all possible variables all the time. There are conditions that we offer up. They're written into the recommendations, can be refined still as we go forward. But essentially, we argue that there should be a conceptual or theoretical reason why a certain variable would even be thought to matter, and there should be some empirical evidence that it does. We give as an example of what should not be adjusted as central line infections, where if the processes are completely under the control of the provider, there's no logical reason why something like poverty or illiteracy should matter in this. You wouldn't want to adjust that. But there are clearly many other measures where we think you should. And bottom line is we think a major consideration in all this should be the accuracy, the lack of bias, and the information value regarding quality of care of the measures that are provided. And we do believe that in many situations, adjustment is required to achieve that. Okay, next slide. So we're just going to, these are basically a paraphrase of the recommendations. You have the full written recommendations in the draft report that was sent out a few days ago. So the first thing is that we would suggest, in fact recommend, that the current NQF wording be revised to include a favorable statement about sociodemographic factors in adjustment, but it does come with this caveat that would be woven in there, that you would not do that adjustment if the factor in question exerts its influence primarily through quality of care, and we can get into that in more detail in the discussion. As you saw earlier, we basically believe that the same guidelines that one uses to select clinical factors should also apply to sociodemographic factors. We're much more impressed with the similarities between these two classes than differences. And as we just said on the prior slide, and this perhaps would be the key recommendation of the entire set, that for most uses that we refer to here as accountability applications, adjustment is appropriate and desirable. But there are other analytic goals, including the focus on disparities, for which stratification is done. And just as a side comment, we do not believe that these are strictly either-or decisions. It is possible to do either or both of these with the same measures, with some of the same variables. So we're arguing that it's not just a once-and-for-all choice you have to make, that there are different things you can do in the same data set. And as we go on in the recommendations, we do ask measure developers in their submissions to NQF to include some information about the rationale for including or not including sociodemographic factors, the ones they were able to examine, what the empirical evidence is, either in their own hands or by someone else, and then eventually how those factors are or are not in the measure proposed. Next slide, please. Now, we do mention that developers should also include some discussion about how the proposed adjustment approach, or lack thereof, would affect disadvantaged populations. And since we recognize that not all potential adjustment variables are readily available now in either claims data sets or other data sets that are used to generate measures, that there's much additional work to be done about making possible adjustment variables available. on a lot of things now are not regularly collected, at least in all provider settings of interest. So more work to be done there. The last two recommendations take a little different tack. They talk about more the larger context of NQF endorsements, with the idea that the endorsement process should include some statements about proper use of the measures, where they make sense, where they don't make sense, so that the endorsement might then in the end be, I don't know if we call it conditional, or it might be just detailed in terms of saying more about the proper purposes and uses of measures and also identifying purposes that are not a good idea. Next slide, please. Okay, we get into this one with a little trepidation, so it's going to take a little time to walk through, but we felt it was useful to spend a few minutes here this afternoon on this one because it illustrates at least two key points about sort of the sum total of our recommendations. So if you'll bear with us a little bit, I'll try to walk through. We suffer here from lack of a laser pointer that we would have if we had this in front of us in a room, but we'll go ahead. We're basically trying to show you an example of one particular approach to adjustment. This would be indirect standardization. It is not the only approach. It is not always the best approach, but it is an example that illustrates a couple things. Just to orient you to the general framework, if we look at the columns, basically what we're talking about here is just some arbitrary performance measure. It's a bad thing that happens. It doesn't happen that often. So you might imagine mortality. You might imagine infection. An outcome measure reflecting a bad thing doesn't happen too often. We're looking at numbers where you examine this in a national population and then in three specific providers called here A, B, and C. If you just look first at the national population, this column over to the left-hand side, we've also just said, for simplicity, let's say income is the variable we care about here. And in the national data, 80% of the people are average or high income, 20% are low income. But income matters. So in the national data, this bad thing happens 2% of the time to average or high income folks. Happens 3% of the time to low-income folks. So that's what you're seeing in sort of on the left-hand side of the table. And then when you just do the simple average of that, the overall national rate, 2.2%. Okay, so that's the national context. So now let's look at the three providers and look at the sub-columns called N. Provider A is just exactly like the national average, 800 high income or average income people, 200 low income. Providers B and C are different in terms of who they serve. They serve much more predominantly low income population. Both of them have 600 low income, 400 average to high income. So provider B and C are like each other in who they serve, and then they're different from A, different from the national average. Okay, now back to provider A. Provider A's actual performance is just average. It is absolutely average, like the national rate, 2% for the one group, 3% for the other group, and you just do the arithmetic and they report out at 2.2. But here's now where the story gets a little richer. Provider B, whose actual performance, again, for each of these two groups is absolutely average, 2% for the high and average income, 3%. But because of the different numbers of people, the rate that is actually calculated and in the current environment reported is 2.6%. That's what you see up near the top of that column. And they look worse than average, even though in our made-up example, their performance is average. Then if you go over to provider C, this time, the performance really is worse than average in the low-income group, 3.5% rather than 3%. Now, in the current environment, when you just do that arithmetic, their apparent rate is even worse than B, 2.9%, and also worse than the national average, 2.2. So if you look at that row that's called all patients, this is what's essentially the situation we have now. Provider A is average, looks average. Provider B has a different case mix in terms of income. Performance is actually average, looks worse than average. C truly is a little worse than average and, in fact, looks considerably worse than average. Now, we're going to skip over some intervening arithmetic, but if we just drop to the bottom row, the effect of this particular method of adjustment is that now A and B, whose performance in each group is actually identical, now have identical rates, which we believe is as it should be. But C, who's actually truly a bit worse than average, does still, even with adjustment, look worse than average, and we believe that is also as it should be. But this is now number one of the key points. The effect of adjustment here has not been to completely wash away differences in quality. The differences in quality are still visible in the bottom row, where in the one place where it exists. Its magnitude is probably expressed a little more accurately here than it was up on the row on top. And the other key point is that as this method works its way through, disparities are still clearly visible because there's a stratification step that you see in the middle of the table. So we can see for each provider, how do you do with the high income? How do you do with the low income? Are they the same? Are they different? Are they better or worse than national average for each of these two groups? So in this particular illustration, disparities do not go away, but we think that the true performance of the organizations is reflected better with the adjustment than without. Okay, next slide, please. And sorry, my computer just froze here. Let me bounce back to Helen and Karen. We have a set of discussion questions here. I can lead a walkthrough one at a time, or this may be the point, having us talk for quite a while, to just open this up for discussion with questions in any order. Helen, what do you prefer?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. That was great. So these are actually the questions that Christy shared with us. So I'm going to turn it back over to Christy Travis, who's chairing the call, to see how she'd like to handle this. I think you've answered a good number of these, so perhaps we'll see how Christy would like to take it from here. Christy?
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Helen, and thank you, Dave and Kevin, for walking us through that. I know it was extremely helpful to me, especially to see the example at the end, so thank you so much for that. I don't think we need to walk through these questions one by one by any means. They were really more just to kind of share with you where my thoughts were after my initial view of reading of the material. And I think that they will probably come up during our conversation, if not worded this way, worded in other ways. I think it would be better, Helen, if it's okay with you all, for us to kind of maybe go on and see if there are some clarifying questions that members of the CSAC have relative to what's been presented and what may have been in the report that was not specifically talked about in the presentation. Would that be a good place to go, Helen?
That sounds great. Thanks, Christy.
So unfortunately, I won't be able to see anybody raising their hand or raising their card. So please bear with me if I somehow miss you and you want to participate. Just keep letting me know along the way. If you will, please, if you have a question, a clarifying question or a comment, if you'll identify yourself, and if it's, if your question or your comment is for any specific individual, if you'll please state so, I would really appreciate it.
Great.
So I will open it up to some of the CSAC members.
Great.
Yeah, Christy, are you just, I just want to understand the process here. You were very specific in saying a clarifying question. Are you going to come back around after clarifying question to some discussion?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you for that. I do think it might be good right now just to focus a little bit of time on clarifying questions. And then once we've had an opportunity to do that, then I think comments and discussions would be in order. So thank you for asking me that.
Hi, this is Lee Fleischer. Great presentation and a thorough analysis. one of the questions is, you outline what I believe is correct in that there are some cases in which if you risk adjust, you would actually lose the what you're trying to show by adding in socioeconomic because it shouldn't be relevant. For example, the hospital setting as the example is included. How do you see this being operationalized as far as what's the burden of evidence to say something should or shouldn't have a SES risk adjustment included?
Dave here, I can give one quick answer, and then Karen and Kevin may wish to follow with more detail. This is an issue the panel talked about at great length and actually still has some work to do to resolve, and I'm particularly thinking of your phrasing of it as burden of proof. About half the panel felt that the burden of proof essentially should be on developers to show that a set of socio-demographics should not be in with the idea that the default approach is that they should. The other half of the panel kind of went the other way and said, well, no, that's really too strong that want the developer to bring forward sort of positive evidence that a factor should be included, but you don't make the starting assumption that they naturally would be at the start. So I think there's still some more discussion to go on that. I don't know that we strictly need to resolve that in the panel discussion, unless by the next couple of phone calls we can do that, meaning that whatever general philosophy on this currently applies for clinical adjustment might just be brought forward into the domain of sociodemographic adjustment so that whatever burden of proof is understood to be on developers now in the clinical domain just might be extended to the sociodemographic domain. We anticipate in practice that developers would first consider on any given measure whether there is any body of evidence about the effects of these sociodemographic factors and or theoretical conceptual reasons. I know at this point we kind of dodged the question of where exactly is the burden of proof, but then the NQF panels who review and ultimately endorse measures presumably can bring their own perspectives and their own experience to bear. And maybe the answer to this question is not going to be one single answer across all measures. Perhaps it might vary where in certain measure domains you might tip the burden of proof one way, in another set of measures you may tip it the other. So short version of that is the panel's still discussing that point.
Okay, thank you.
Chris,
yeah. This
is Lee. Can I follow up on other Lee's questions? Because I think he's thinking about the same thing I am, which is in part the burden that this would impose on the developers. And in another discussion last week, this issue came up in connection with a discussion of the CAPS survey. And in that instance, Paul Cleary from Yale was on the other end of the line, and he said that actually there is a certain amount of SES data incorporated in the CAP survey. And they did some work and discovered that adjusting didn't make any difference at all in the results. So in a way, you might be saying to a developer, show us what happens when you do it either way. It would just be an additional step. Did your committee talk about that at all?
Yes. This is Kevin Fasella. And just to follow up on Dave's earlier point, which I think reflects on your question as well, that there was a long discussion, and I think Dave characterized it very well. I think there's certainly a large segment of the committee who is particularly concerned regarding how resources flow based on pay for performance and what the ultimate impact would be on patient care, particularly for disadvantaged patients, so that if they're penalized, they get less, and now they have even less resources to do that. And so related to that question is the impact that adjustment could have on rankings. And so there are differences between, you know, how much variance adding an SES or any factor to a, you know, a big model is going to contribute, you know, how much would the model fit and prove, and often the answer is it's relatively small. But related to that is, well, what is the impact when one does do that on the actual rankings? Because even relatively very small effects can produce some bias in how those rankings play out and impacts on pay for performance for safety net practices, which is probably a little bit different than the issue of clinical risk adjustment. So I think our message to developers was to consider both pieces, both what's the actual impact on the model performance, recognizing the addition of any additional factors, likely to be modest, as Paul Cleary and others have noted, but also what's the potential impact on actual rankings and how those resources flow under current use under pay for performance.
Thank you. I just one quick additional one. I know that one of your recommendations is there's obviously got to be work on how we can effectively collect a lot of this socio-demographic information so it can be actually used and incorporated in measures. And did the committee discuss at all the timing of when the change in policy should go into effect in view of the fact that a lot of that work still remains to be done?
Dave here. I don't know that we had a discussion specifically on timing, meaning pick a date or a date range. My own personal guess is that this is just going to be a constantly evolving situation in the sense of the number of data elements collected, the accuracy, the granularity of those data. The situation's a little bit like the situation on the IOM committee I chaired a couple of years ago about race and ethnicity data. Once you begin to incorporate data into measurement or into adjustment of measurement, you find the data collection gets better. So my own personal sense is you start now working with what you have, and you just realize that there may be some things you might want to adjust for that you just can't, but maybe 5 years from now you can, and then the measure specs would be modified when that opportunity arises. So I just don't know if we can anticipate a particular date in the near future where the situation as far as data availability will just be markedly and suddenly different than it is now. I think it'll just evolve gradually.
Yeah, this is Kevin. I agree. I don't think we had an explicit discussion around this, although I think implicitly it was that we would go with the current measures, however imperfect, and then as Dave suggests, these measures will evolve and improve over time.
So a corollary to that, this is Andy Baskin. I'm sorry. I guess I don't understand. So we're saying that because the data may not be available or it may not be possible to do this kind of socio-demographic risk adjustment today, that we would essentially, even though we know that there's maybe some general evidence that those factors do make a difference in this measure and it would be appropriately adjusted, but because the data may not be available, we'll let a measure go through knowing that it would be modified in the future. And I guess I'm looking at, are we doing the exact 180-degree opposite harm by letting measures out now that we know should be adjusted and are not being adjusted and used in an accountability type of setting? So it's sort of like you're darned if you do, darned if you don't. Are we doing harm in the other direction?
Well, I guess I'd have to say that the current position of the panel is indeed influenced by a concern that harm may be currently being done by the absence of adjustment. I think that's fair. Now, exactly how that affects the overall NQF process of endorsement, I don't think we were asked to speak about that directly, so we didn't. But the potential harm of unadjusted measures is, you know, woven through our report, and it represents the rationale for what we're suggesting. I think that, again, an analogous situation to race and ethnicity, specifically. There are some ways in which one can use sort of temporary bridge strategies or patch strategies. And I'm thinking that, just use the hospital setting for example, it's generally possible to link patient address data to then census data with which one can either characterize the individual patient's neighborhood on their dimensions like income, education, housing stock, things like that, or you can make the inference and impute it to the individual patient. But either way, you take a data element that you do have, and then you link it in a way that allows you to then bring in conceptually some data that you don't have. It's not the ideal way to do it in a, you know, ideal world, but it's a practical approach that has been used successfully in a number of other instances. So I guess where we'd end up is to say, you know, we should try to do the best job we have with the data either directly available or inferable through things like census linkage, try to make that better and better as we go forward in the future. And then a separate consideration would just be, is there active evidence of harm with measures that are currently unadjusted? And again, we, on the panel, we're not asked to speak to that point directly, but the concern is indeed part of our thinking.
Yeah, so Sandy, if I may just if I may just comment and return to that since I started this path. The whole idea of using census data, zip code data, I find rather troublesome and in fact has just as much room for error in terms of misclassification of providers as not using it. But and I think of my own zip code where within six blocks of one provider to another, you're either at a clinic that deals with a population obviously is very different than the population six blocks away that goes to that particular provider, and that's all within the same zip code. But I guess my other question is, where does sociodemographic data stop? And I'm thinking in terms of the funding source for a particular provider is probably, in other words, the per capita money they have to take care of patients if they're funded through a program could probably be just as great a factor as the demographics of the patients that actually walk into the clinic, and is where is the end of sociodemographic data? What is not considered sociodemographic for this purpose? And funding is specifically, I guess, the example I can think of. And I think it's analogous to, like, the per capita spending on students in a school district makes a big difference, regardless of the population of the students themselves. So does that make a difference in performance and should be one of the sociodemographic data elements?
This is Kevin. I think there's two elements here that I'll try to respond to. So the first is that payers can potentially be used as an index of individual FES, and we've had discussions regarding its limitations, particularly Medicaid. So, for example, among the 25 states and the District of Columbia who have opted for expanding Medicaid, that's a pretty good individual measure of having a household income of 138% or less of federal poverty. So we're probably not going to have a better measure of household income, at least there. The problem is for the other 25 states who have not yet opted in, there's more heterogeneity in terms of who qualifies for Medicaid and not. So that would be using a payer, in essence, as a proxy, or in this case, a pretty good one for individual level FES. I think the other question you're asking, which is an important one, which gets at, you know, resources. So we know that, for example, based on the particular state, Medicaid may pay more or less to a particular provider, which then affects what the provider themselves can do. And there was indeed a great deal of discussion about that. Now, that is an example where perhaps a peer-based comparison, where one compares similar types of providers that perhaps receive their funding through a similar stream. So, you know, an example would be perhaps comparing all federally qualified health centers as a group that might be more meaningful, even if one did some other adjustments like HRSA does in terms of adjusting the quality measures. There you're accounting for a similar, somewhat similar stream of revenue coming to the providers. Does that answer your question?
It's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andy.
Hi, Christy. Dana Safran.
Yes, Dana. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to get in the queue. This is Ann.
Okay. Thanks, Ann. Dana?
Thank you, Christy. I have four questions. And first, just to say thank you to this group for a very clear presentation on a very complex topic. So my first question for you has to do with the core principles that you outlined, and specifically on the 10th slide, principle number 4, where you're really at the heart of the matter here, that outcomes can be influenced by health status, clinical, socio-demographic factors, in addition to quality and effectiveness. My question really is how and when we think we know what's driving what. Because it's very often the case that we'll see disparities, but it's because we've had a model of payment or a delivery system model or both that haven't been targeted or rewarding addressing those disparities, and that when we do, those differences that appear to be sociodemographically related can oftentimes disappear. And I'll give you a concrete example of that. But first I'll say, you know, so I think this concept and concern is best captured by statement Tom Sequest, who's done a lot of research in this area, has made, which is that the problem of disparities is not one of treating patients differently. It's one of treating all patients the same and expecting to be able to get a good result across the board. Because we all understand that adherence is a key driver of some of the outcomes we're going to want to be looking at and creating accountability for. And what it takes to drive adherence in one population can be quite different from another. So, in fact, in the payment reform work that I've been involved in, we've seen some of the provider organizations in our network who have been among the lowest performers and also had among the worst socioeconomic case mix in terms of vulnerability of their population go from near the bottom to outperforming everybody else in a relatively brief span of time on outcome measures. And it's because they have been incentivized on those outcome measures, taken a hard look at what they have to do differently, given that they do have a low socioeconomic mix, and redesigned care so that they can actually get good blood pressure, good control, good cholesterol control, good hemoglobin A1C control in their patient population. And so they're now outperforming everybody else. So, you know, I apologize for sort of going way into the weeds with a detailed example like that, but it really calls this important question of how do we know that the time has come to adjust for something, as opposed to, you know, we really haven't actually tried to get the incentives or the delivery model right to make these disparities go away. So I'll pause there, and then if Christy will allow, I have three other briefer questions for you.
Let's get that one answered first.
Okay, this is Kevin. You know, I think that's a really great and important question. You know, I would bet that had you adjusted for SES, that your lowest performing provider would still be lowest performing. I doubt that they suddenly would have looked completely average. And conversely, or certainly if you adjusted for SES, he would remain an outstanding performer following their intervention. And I think that that this sort of reflects an important issue, which is that when one takes something like adherence, and I think that's a great example, it is both under, somewhat under the control of the provider. There are steps that the provider can take to enhance adherence, no doubt. But ultimately, it is the patient who is gonna make that decision, and in that sense, exert the most control. And so, if one has a disadvantaged population that is confronted with a variety of adherence barriers, whether they be language, low literacy, cost, etc., there are steps that providers can take, as your work has illustrated, and I think, you know, I think you've correctly, by implication, implied three things. One is motivation and incentives, and that was a bit outside the scope of our committee, but I think is implicit in some of the models and the way we're talking about that. But I think that requires a separate strategy of specifically identifying those disparities and then figuring out viable strategies at whatever level to address them. The second issue is having adequate resources to do that, and certainly if there's fewer resources, one's impact ability to mitigate these factors is blunted. And the last one is then having in place an effective strategy for doing that, in this case practice redesign. So I don't think that the issue of statistical adjustment here necessarily would change your findings, and the issue of how does one incentivize reduction of disparities, I think is an important question, but was outside the scope of this particular committee.
Kevin, this is Karen Pace. Some people are having a little bit difficulty hearing you, so I don't know if you're on a speakerphone. If so, if you could try the other way, but just to,
Is it better now? Is this better or no?
I think that's better.
Okay.
Thanks.
Christina, can I combine my second and third questions?
I'll tell you what, since it's so hard for me to see how long the line is, I would really appreciate it, if you don't mind, if we move to Ann, and then if we have time, we can come back, because I would hate for people not to be able to ask their question. So I appreciate your patience, and I think if it's okay, we'll just move to Ann, and then we can come back around. I've made a note that you have other questions.
And Christy, this is Helen. I just want to let you know, Frank is in a noisy place at ARC and has a question he's typed into the box after Ann, perhaps you could go to him.
Okay. That would be great. So, Ann?
Thank you, Christy. You know, the conceptual discussion of this is in many ways way beyond me, and I have to trust my colleagues on CSAC who are much more familiar with these concepts than I am. But I just want to share an observation that I have through this. This all sounds to me like it's about making sure that providers are being, I don't want to word this, being rewarded or measured in a way that has a very narrow definition of what the role of providers is. And it's not looking at it from the side of the patient. And I really appreciate Dana's comments, because my question after that and your response is if adjusting for all these things is not going to make that much of a difference, then why are we doing it? Why would we do it when I'm very concerned that it can be interpreted as blunting the impact of inadequate care and systems that are not designed for the cultural populations we serve, as a way of getting around that. And so my question is one of why is NQF considering this when it really is not a patient-centered concept, I don't believe. It is a provider-centered concept, and it's from the inside out as opposed to the outside in. It's like saying with patient experience measures that it's enough that we told people that they're supposed to, about their medications, but the fact that they didn't get it is somehow unrelated to our responsibility. And I'm troubled by that with the understanding that I may not understand it totally, but it does not feel to me to be a true patient-driven way of looking at such a complex thing. It's more of a provider way of looking at it and to minimize their responsibility for this wider range of need that many of our populations have. I'll stop there.
Yeah. Daisy, let me take a first response, and then Karen and Kevin and others certainly can step in as well. I can see how the recommendations here and the rest of the report could have the appearance that you just described. I don't think that is the reality, though. I think the members of the panel are deeply interested in what ultimately protects patients. And certainly Kevin and I individually, others on the panel, have essentially devoted most or all of our professional careers to issues of reducing, eliminating disparities. And the recommendations in our minds do address concerns about effects on patients and effects on disparities. The key dynamic that I think we have been worried about was captured in one of the slides. I don't have it here numbered in front of me, but it's the issue of the lack of adjustment and therefore what we consider to be sort of inaccurate or possibly misleading measures in terms of whether they do or not reflect quality, having the effect of reducing access because of fewer resources to safety net providers, we'll call them for convenience, providers choosing to avoid serving disadvantaged populations. And it's a deep and difficult issue, and I think those of us on the call right now may make different assumptions about what measurement does to providers. In one view of the world, measures provide incentives change behavior moves in the direction we want it to move, and then good things happen if we've designed it correctly. But sometimes we don't know what the behavior change is going to be, and the panel was concerned that the current absence of adjustment through two or three different specific mechanisms that we name would result in providers avoiding disadvantaged populations or trying to stick it out but losing money through things like readmission penalties and having adverse effects on these populations that we care about. So I don't think I would accept the characterization that this is not patient-centric, even though it might appear to be. I think we are worried about patients.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. You know, I've worked in federally qualified health centers for 30 years and continue to see patients. Hello? Hello?
I hear you.
Christy?
Kevin, go ahead.
Yes, just hold it just a moment, if you can.
Sure.
Yeah, I wanted to say I deal with this issue as a family physician. Every time I see patients, so this is a constant effort, and I strongly believe that there are things that clinicians can do to address these disparities. But what it requires is resources. It requires more resources. It requires, in some cases, language translation. And sometimes it requires somebody having a case manager. It requires somebody having a health educator. It requires a whole range. It requires quality improvement infrastructure. These are critical resources that are needed. And I think that there was a sense among the committee. I don't think largely among the committee members, most of whom are probably salaried, and it's not going to impact their own personal pay, but the impact that those resources would have on the ability to actually provide adequate care to socially disadvantaged patients. I think it is patient-centered, because one needs to be able to match the adequacy of the resources to the needs of the patients. And if the ultimate impact is the opposite, to actually diminish resources than it's having the opposite effect we want. I think it's also patient-centered in that it provides patients with actually more valid data on the actual performance in terms of when they are selecting a provider or health plan or what have you, because you're accounting for factors that have not been previously accounted for. And so, whereas it might be in some sense viewed as helping the provider, if it provides a more a valid inference for patients, contractors, policymakers, then in that sense, I think it is a more patient-centered measure than currently exists.
Thank you, Kevin. We have a question from Frank. Do you want to read it, Helen?
He's pulling it up unless Frank wants to come off mute for a moment and ask himself.
Okay, one or the other.
Well, go ahead. It says the presentation stated that risk adjustment is more accurate. Oh, we just lost us.
Yeah, you can still read it.
Presentation stated risk adjustment is more accurate than other alternatives. Stratification and peer group analysis are not accurate. For purposes of accountability, risk adjustment allows for smoothing out bias on rankability, but I am less clear about its role in accuracy. So I guess he's really asking whether there's any reason to think that stratification and peer group analysis would also not be accurate in terms of rank.
Well, Dave, here, I'll take a first swing, and then we can go on beyond that. Accuracy isn't always just a pure black and white yes or no situation. I think there are probably degrees of accuracy, and I think when we were using that term, we were starting with an underlying assumption that the outcomes class of measures that we're talking about in many cases are only loosely related to the underlying processes of care that are under the control of doctors or hospitals or anybody else. So what you see in the outcome measure is not a pure and simple reflection of actual quality of care. So that's just kind of basic assumption. So when we talk about accurate, some of the implication of that word is the extent to which you see the true underlying quality differences in process in the outcome. So that there's a little additional language there. Then if we take peer group comparison, for example, it does some good things, particularly when the context of use is applying financial penalties. Groups are providers are compared against others alike. Rewards and penalties are assigned, and presumably that's a fairer and possibly better process than otherwise. But in that process, the number itself that is used to represent performance, we would still argue is not as accurate a measure of true underlying quality as it could be, because you've still got the effect of the sociodemographic factors in there. Yes, you're grouping people to give or take away money, but you still got a number, and we could think back to our little example of indirect stratification as an example. You know, if that 2.6 or 2.9 is still out there as the public label of what people are doing, that's the sense in which you're using the term inaccurate. Now, the stratification is more accurate and perhaps more transparent. The problem there is that many of our pay-for-performance applications and public reporting things just aren't set up to deal with the complexities of stratified reports. Our example was a simple little one. We just had two groups, but you might have four variables, each of which four or five meaningful categories, meaning you got 20 categories of performance. The number in each one might now be accurate, but it's a complex thing to look at. So I hope that explains a little bit that the our use of the term accurate is kind of nuanced. It's not just all yes or all no.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. And I know somebody was trying to get in with a question a moment ago. This is your turn.
No, I just wanted to. I think Ann hit the nail on the head in the issue about blunting providers' enthusiasm for improve or not recognizing a poor performance. But I want to address that. The that have adverse selection in disadvantaged populations. And we've got a fair amount of experience in Detroit on this topic. Our group, for instance, has 36 offices spread throughout southeastern Michigan. They range in neighborhoods from the richest to the poorest neighborhoods in the metropolitan area. We in the disadvantaged locations, we do put in extra resources. We have culturally compatible providers in those offices, and despite applying things that, you know, to the best of our capability or knowledge, there are significant differences from site to site in HEDIS performance measures. And this is when the sites have all the same information system, the same performance parameters, the same hiring requirements for provider staff. So I think we've got to begin to recognize the disparity that exists among providers and the kind of populations they take care of, and begin to blunt some of the unfair measurements that are happening today. And I think that's the purpose of this this fabulous report from this this task group.
Thank you. Do we have others with clarifying questions? I know Dana's got a few if we don't have anybody else, but is there anybody else out there?
Just one question about stratification. It's Andy. When you mentioned stratification, I know you talked about different parameters of stratification, so there could be, you know, what you gave an example of high income, low income. Of course, there can be two or three parameters that are in the mix for stratification. But is the simplest form of stratification that you would, or would you agree the simplest form is to report a measure with stratification, without stratification? With meaning if you have three parameters, all three together, and that's the new score when you stratify on these parameters, or are you talking about literally putting a score out for each parameter that's in the socio-demographic adjustment?
Yeah, when we use the term stratification, we would be talking about reporting a separate performance score for each stratum or each combination of strata. So, you know, to say you got five variables, four categories in each, actually you would report 20 numbers, not one number. That is the essence of stratified reporting or stratification. Now, in our example, that table that we walked through, that's just an intermediate step of then moving to a single adjusted number, and it's that second part that is adjustment. So in that case, you've got stratification and adjustment kind of as first and second steps in the same process. But just to hopefully be clear, when we talk about stratification in our report and we recommend it as a way to examine disparities, we're talking about the separate reporting of performance in meaningful groups.
Okay. I was separate. Just thinking, is there another meaningful way to report, which is report with and without socio-demographic risk adjustment? Just, you know, one number, without and with.
Absolutely yes.
Okay, thank you.
Dana, do you have another question?
Yeah, thanks. And Andy's question actually covered one of mine, so I'll try to combine the other two. It relates to the fact that that introducing risk adjustment increases the variability in any number that we're going to have, and so I just wonder if the committee has contemplated the issue of display, you know, because I hope we're all assuming that we're not going to be reporting actual numbers, that if our audience that we're concerned about making the wrong inferences here is public, that, you know, typically what we're sharing with them is some kind of categorical set of information. And so I'm interested in what the committee is suggesting that we do, given the increased variability that gets attached to these numbers after we adjust to compensate for that fact. And the thing that I think is related to it, so I'll just tack it on to that question, relates back to, I think, Kevin, something you were saying in response to my earlier question, which is, well, it's really not going to change the provider's position very much. And I think that really is part of the heart of the matter here, that is what you're showing us and looks so compelling in that table is how the number changes. But if we take as a given that it's not the number that's going to be displayed, it's going to be sort of a relative position in terms of performance, then I believe what the evidence has showed, and your answer to my question suggests it's what you're finding too, is that adjustment can sometimes close the gap, you know, close the gap between providers and change the amount of variability that we see across providers, but it rarely changes the rankings significantly. So assuming we're not publishing individual rankings but rather groupings, I think that issue is important and kind of brings back the question of, so why should we bother? If it's making our point estimates noisier and at the end of the day isn't really moving people to a different place in the data the way it's going to be displayed, you know, are we doing a disservice? So I hope that's a clear question or two questions.
Just if I could, Dave here, if I could just do a preface and then I'll flip it to Kevin. I don't think our committee has accepted the premise or the assumption that nothing meaningful would happen either in scores or relative ranks or ultimate classifications. We have some published articles in front of us. I'm thinking of one off the top of my head at the health plan level, doing this kind of adjustment just on a research and trial basis, where there was significant movement. And I also observe that when you get into a system like star rankings, it's the border between adjacent rankings that often matters. And if adjustment even has a relatively small effect in terms of something like overall R-square, it might turn a five-star plan into a four-star or a one-star into a three-star with a little more movement. So I don't think we ought to go into this with just the unquestioned assumption that nothing meaningful would happen. I think we don't know that yet, and we have examples, at least in some test runs, published test runs, where meaningful things do happen. So, flip to Kevin.
Karen, can I just make one comment about the display? I think this is part of the recommendation that NQF consider expanding its role into implementation guidance, but right now what NQF endorses is the performance measure as it's computed, not necessarily how an implementer might do different cut points or who gets how many stars. So, to answer your question, the committee didn't really address the display. And, you know, they have a general recommendation that NQF should consider getting into that space. But I'll stop there and let Kevin pick up.
Yeah, just to clarify what I meant, what I was saying is that if a group is a true outlier, as apparently this one group was before their quality improvement project, and then again at the end they completely flipped, that it probably is not going to change that they're near the bottom or in the bottom, or whatever you have, quintile or quartile, or and move into the top. That probably wouldn't change. I wasn't saying that it's not going to affect ranking at all. And I agree with David. I think it really depends on the particular measure. I think there is empiric evidence for some measures where adjustment is likely to have a significant effect on ranking, and an example that just comes to mind offhand would be medication adherence, for example. I think the second reason to do it, in addition to sound scientific reasons, is acceptability. I think as we move to outcome measures, many providers feel like, well, hey, my patients are different, and if you don't account for this, there's much less buy-in and belief in the validity of the measure. So I think that in addition to good scientific soundness reasons for adjusting,
that there are reasons related to the acceptability of the measure as well.
Thank you. Other clarifying questions from any CSAC members?
Christy, Frank had one more, although I'm not sure it qualifies as clarifying. but it's something I think we've kind of been talking about, which he specifically asked the question of the chairs. Where did I just typed it? Where did it go? Oh, good. There it is. Fascinating discussion. Vulnerable patients. Is it really about misclassifying providers, or is it about driving improvement? What drives the highest interest in the best care for one of the toughest populations? I think it borders on the next section, Christy, but he's the chair, so we'll let him have it.
Definitely.
Any comments? I mean, I think
sure.
We talked about
this. No, I think that, you know, we didn't really directly address this, but I think it relates to the issue of that is in the report of the importance of identifying and addressing disparities. So I think if one were to produce, for example, stratified measures by social disadvantage, and then tie those to some sort of reward or I guess even penalty, then that would provide an additional incentive beyond whatever the mission of that organization was to improve care to that group. So I think you need specific strategies to do that are a little bit outside the purview of this committee, but I think it's an important question.
Yeah, Dave, here, just one other point that we haven't really touched on too much here, and I'll admit right off the top here, others on this call may be far more expert on this particular point than I am. I think there's a pretty decent body of evidence, though, that across all sorts of provider types, simply the provision of good, clear, accurate, and accepted information on quality set against peer comparisons can drive improvement. Now, we've talked about incentives of other types, financial incentives, this and that, and obviously, yes, they can drive improvement also. But I don't think that there's just naturally a dichotomy or an automatic dichotomy between accurate measurement on the one hand and drive improvement on the other. I'm not sure you always have to trade those off. My general thought is we should look for where they go together, and that is that if socio-demographic adjustment produces measures that providers accept as more valid, more accurate, more fair in their comparisons with others, that one thing alone may be a positive force to drive improvement, as opposed to a situation where measures are rejected as perceived as just being inaccurate and biased.
Well, Dave, this is Christy, and my question that I had was really similar, I think, to Frank's. And in the example that you all walked through, the provider B, I think it was, that was performing at the national average but had, you know, the much higher, lower income population, you know, going through the adjustment process, they would get the same, they would get the national average score. And so I understand the math. But I'm trying to think through how does doing it that way, and if that is what is made transparent through the accountability of public reporting and maybe also through the accountability of payment, but let's just take public reporting for an example. If it's left at that, then it is not where is the incentive to change the national average for the low income population. In other words, how do we get that national average, which I think was 3% in your example, down to 2%, or how, you know, or get the 2%, you know, how do we get the movement if we have adjusted it such that it looks like you're at the national average, so you're fine?
Well, I think one answer that actually I've been using myself for now close to two decades in all the work that I've done about disparities in the context of HEDIS measures and managed care plans, is that as long as there's any sort of incentive for improvement in the average, certainly a path to do that, and then an even stronger path if you do serve a lot of disadvantaged patients, is you got to get better at those patients. And you may debate, and I think we are debating here, you know, what the appropriate starting point is to launch improvement in terms of what your measure looks like and what it reflects. But even in that example, and I'll just, you know, link back to your comment, if we start with, you know, saying that, okay, this provider really is 2.2 and is effectively right now average, there, that if we use the star analogy, okay, now you're a 3-star. But you can still have incentives for performing at 4 or 5-star levels. Those incentives are still clear. And the provider, in looking at its own data, may see that the best opportunity for improvement is, in fact, to get better at the low-income patients and then figure out how to do it. And then doing it will have a relatively larger impact in its setting than it does in provider A's setting. So I don't really accept the idea that the incentives are gone just because we have made the measure what, in my view, would be more accurate. I think incentives can still be there, are still there.
Thank you.
And Christy, just to also let you know, we have some expert panel members who would like to weigh in, perhaps after you get through the CSAC question.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, Christy, I have a question. It's Andy. I think this
okay.
is still for this part of this discussion. So, I mean, it's obviously been acknowledged that access to data for sociodemographic data is going to be very limited in most applications other than probably very large populations or very limited focused, you know, I can think of maybe an integrated, small integrated delivery system where they may have this, but generally speaking, the information is not available, the data. And, of course, we've talked about the possibility of using, you know, census-type data, population-type data that's outside of a particular healthcare provider setting or healthcare delivery-derived information. Is the thought being, it would seem to me that the accuracy of that data could have a huge impact on the results of the risk adjustment. Is the proposal that when sociodemographic data risk adjustment should be as an appropriate setting for it, that there would also then require to be some assessment of the accuracy of the data so that, of course, poor data wouldn't actually result in now misclassification, even based on sociodemographic information we'd be misclassifying because the data would just simply not be of an accurate enough degree, and I'm not sure how you would measure that, to make it worthwhile using. Is the thought that we would have to develop that, or we would simply say, hey, use what data you got, and, you know, we'll, you know, since you should use it, we'll just accept whatever the best you have. It seems like a leap of faith to me.
This is Kevin. That's a great question. I think it depends in part on the type of SES or SES-related data that one is speaking to. I mentioned Medicaid earlier, and that's probably pretty good. The issue being the differences between states, but probably within state, it's fairly verifiable, and I'm not sure how one would go about trying to conduct further validation on that. When one moves on to area-based socioeconomic measures, there's empiric literature on that, and I think as you or somebody else mentioned, certainly at a zip code level, there is greater heterogeneity on average, and that will differ between different communities. I think as one begins to move down to a smaller unit, such as a census tract or even a smaller census unit of analysis, one is likely to see less heterogeneity than one sees at a zip code level. We did not specifically address the issue of asking developers to try to validate the quality of that of that information. I guess in a similar way that we don't ask them to validate the quality of the clinical measures that are coming oftentimes through claims data and may be of varying quality.
Actually, I do think there is some requirement to validate that claims-based data in the NQF criteria, so I don't think it's quite analogous. And when you move out of the Medicaid population into the commercial population, there virtually is no socio-demographic data available other than non-specific, you know, geographic data.
Right.
And that's where I have my concern. Certainly in Medicaid, I agree with you. You'd certainly have more information. I just don't know how to review a measure when someone's using data that I, in my limited knowledge of socio-demographic data sources, would question the accuracy of that data to such a degree that I'd say to myself I could be more harmful using the data than not using data. I don't know how I would develop that criteria or whether someone will, by necessity, have to develop that criteria if we're going to do this.
Well, in theory, one could go back and use census data to look at the heterogeneity within particular tracts, but I think one gets at issues of feasibility and demands on the developer.
Well, it's a very good point raised, Andy, so thank you for bringing that up. Helen, I do want to leave time to be sure that we have an opportunity for comments and suggestions from the CSAC. What's the best way to incorporate the other expert panel members at this time?
Yeah. So we have three in the queue, and I think we'll call it at that just in the interest of time. And perhaps we could just call on each of them for brief comments or just to keep us on track. I'm also sensitive to the fact that we also need to have public comments, of course.
Right.
Public call. So at least on the list showing that's being before me, I would ask Nancy Garrett if she'd like to make a brief comment.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Helen. This is Nancy Garrett from Hennepin County Medical Center. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. So I just wanted to respond to one of the earlier panel members' comments, which I thought was really very astute ones. And I've really appreciated the discussion today. You've asked some questions that are really important for us to address. So one of the comments was the potential harm of letting measures get endorsed that really conceptually should be adjusted for sociodemographic factors, but we can't do it because we don't have the data yet or we weren't able to find a method to do it. And so I just wanted to share that there has been some discussion of that, and I think some panel members believe that if there's a conceptual reason that really should be adjusted and we can't do it, that perhaps that measure shouldn't be endorsed. But we haven't gone to the point, I don't think we have consensus on that in our panel, and I think we're really leaving that up to the expert panels that would be reviewing the measures in terms of really taking our recommendation, which does add this whole new set of criteria around sociodemographics, and figuring out how it would apply in that particular situation. And similarly, we've had some conversation about what if there's a conceptual link and there's not an empirical link because the data we have, we're not seeing a link. And so it could just be that those indicators aren't strong enough yet, again, because of those data availability issues. So do we still include that variable in a statistical model and risk adjust for it to show that it really is important and that eventually we're going to have better data? Or does it come off, which would be the typical approach you would take with clinical risk adjustment factors? So we're definitely wrestling with all of these issues, and we very much appreciate your comments.
Great. Thank you so much, Nancy. Susanna Bernheim? Are you still with us? We may have lost Susanna, or perhaps she's on mute. Let's go to Steve. We'll pop back to Susanna. Steve Lipstein? Uh-oh. Operator, can you be sure that they both have open lines?
Yes, ma'am. Susanna is not online.
And how about Steve Lipstein?
Yes, he is online. His line is open.
Okay, Steve, I think your line's open if you'd like to make a comment.
Great. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Yes. Thank you.
Great. So my name is Steve Lipstein. I'm a member of the panel, and my day job is the president and chief executive of a system of hospitals in St. Louis called BJC Healthcare. So I'm one of the provider organizations whose behavior we're trying to improve. The example, I guess the question I wanted to respond to was the question of why bother to do socio-demographic risk adjustment if it doesn't change some of these large-scale models in the aggregate. And the example I gave at the expert panel, which I think is useful here, is I gave the example of two groups of physicians, one in Scottsdale, Arizona called the Mayo Clinic and one in Detroit called the Henry Ford Health System. And the Henry Ford Health System pays the maximum penalty for readmission rate penalties under the Hospital Readmission Rate Reduction Program. And the Mayo Clinic Scottsdale doesn't pay a penalty at all. And in the absence of sociodemographic risk adjustment, the presumption is that if the Mayo Clinic provider group moved to Detroit, they'd still pay no penalty. And if the Henry Ford group moved to Scottsdale, they would still pay the maximum penalty. And that causes an erosion of credibility or acceptance of the measure. And so even if sociodemographic status risk adjustment doesn't change what somebody referred to as the rankings, it would greatly increase the acceptability of certain outcomes measures that are perceived to be highly variable associated with sociodemographic status. The other brief comment that I would make is that the selection of the sociodemographic risk variable is very, very important. And so while some may want to risk adjust based on either Medicaid eligibility or dual eligibility, what we're finding as we look at our own readmission rates within the organization where I work is that we really do need to get down to the census tract level, and not the census tract where the provider is located, but the census tract where the patient lives, so that if you discharge a patient from a hospital into a community with very low income and very high poverty rates, where with a high percentage of people who didn't graduate from high school, with a high housing vacancy rate and a high unemployment rate, you're essentially discharging patients into a community with no social or economic infrastructure. And when you do that, there's a higher likelihood that they will end up being readmitted back to the hospital because there are no local services, there are no drug stores, no food stores, no taxi cab stands, no local transportation. And that's kind of the real world that we're living in. And so a person who's eligible for Medicaid in a high population density area like Denver, Colorado, is in very different life circumstances than somebody who's eligible for Medicaid in the boot heel of Missouri. And so if you don't have those local resources, it really does affect kind of the degree of difficulty in producing outstanding patient outcomes, which we all desire. And so under the value-based purchasing methodology employed by CMS, for example, if it costs more money to produce a good outcome for a highly vulnerable patient, it's still viewed as a being lower value when you measure the outcome divided by the cost to produce that outcome. So this issue of sociodemographic risk adjustment is of very, very great importance to the provider community, not because we don't want to improve and not because we're not interested in producing better outcomes. It's that we want to make sure there's a fair allocation of federal government resources to produce those outcomes. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to comment.
Thank you.
Can I just add a clarifying comment to that? This isn't a difference between Arizona and Detroit. Our Tony Suburban Hospital has no penalty for readmissions. It's the urban hospital that does, and it's the same people, the same provider, the same information systems, the same processes across both campuses.
Christy, this is Lee. Are we going to have time to make kind of last remarks or a question for our panel before we switch to our next topic, if we have time for it?
Yeah, and we're happy to extend this a bit, Lee. We still have at least one other committee member, but go ahead, and we'll get back to Susanna before we can.
I just wanted to say that I think what the last 2 hours has shown, I hope, all of us how very complicated this issue is and how many questions we all have. Reading through that report, which was very helpful, and the discussion today has raised probably more questions for me than answers. And I know, I understand that the expert committee isn't finished. We're going to still polish or play or work with this. But in particular, I would appreciate it if the experts would focus for on why there. I see absolutely the difference and the impact when we're talking about risk adjustment tied to penalties. I don't see the argument yet for changing the NQF policy with regard to public reporting, and I remain totally unconvinced that that's necessary. So I just hope that as the discussions among the panel goes forward, they will address that distinction.
That's fine. Happy to do that. Thank you.
And Lee, just as a process thing, you know, that we'll be putting this out for comment, and the expert panel will certainly be then addressing all the comments. But
Karen, I think there needs to be more discussion before you put it out for public comment. I think it would really benefit a lot of us if we could have a couple of weeks of base touching among a lot of us who live in this world. I just think we might have a version of this report that was a little more helpful. I'm not sure, but I feel uncomfortable dumping it on a public that hasn't had the benefit of the discussion like we've had this afternoon and the committee deliberations.
This is Chris.
Go ahead.
Go on.
I'll just say that we are going to have a town hall for a discussion with the larger audience, but I know we'll get into that. So, Christy, I'll let you move on with the Susanna and others that want to talk.
Well, just one comment from my perspective as well. I think that several times today, and it may have been Dave, but maybe it was Dave and Kevin, actually said that perhaps the report was not necessarily reflecting the patient-centric nature of what the expert panel focused on. And I think my concern about putting the report out as it's currently written is that I do think there are whole sections where it's all about the provider, and the sections that are about the patient are much smaller and are not as reflected in the final recommendations. And so to Lee's point, I think one of the things that would concern me a little bit about if the report is not reflective of the patient-centric nature of the discussion at the expert panel, then perhaps it could stand a little retooling in order to be based more from the patient perspective versus the provider perspective. Another kind of thought I had is that first recommendation really says that you should include SES adjustment. And I think what I've heard today is that the purpose should drive, the purpose of the measure should be driving what we do, but I'm not sure that's reflected in how the recommendation is worded. So it would seem to me that the thoughtfulness that Lee is suggesting, I'm afraid if we put it out without revisiting some of this, that things could be misinterpreted. And it's very difficult to take first impressions away from people once they have formed them on their own, even if they do attend a town hall call or some other effort on NQF's part to be sure people have an appreciation for the measure. So that was just kind of one of the things I wanted to say, kind of supporting Lee's point here. Is there any flexibility on the timing around this? That was kind of my question, Karen.
This is Helen. I'll take that. I mean, I think we have some flexibility. You know, I don't think we have weeks. I think it's the problem, as you know, this is a deliverable, but we want to get it right. So we can certainly regroup with the chairs after this call and see what is doable. And some of this may just be that, you know, some of the ways things are phrased could be adjusted. But I don't want to speak for the chairs, and I don't know if Karen wants to add anything there.
Yeah, we appreciate your comments and suggestions, and we will, as Helen said, we're planning to consult with the chairs, and we'll be, you know, we really do want, you know, it to be reflective of all the good work of the expert panel, so appreciate your comments.
One thing from a procedural standpoint, Helen, I really would like to give people who haven't had a chance to say anything on the CSAC before we leave this this part of the agenda. And I know we have another item, but I really think it's important if there are people who have not yet had an opportunity to share a comment, that we give them that chance.
I think we can hold off on the other, we don't have to start the other agenda item on that time, right, Helen?
It's fine. We could just tee it up towards the end. I think you should just keep getting any comments that you need, Christy.
Okay, that would be wonderful. I appreciate that. So I guess for those of you who have not yet had an opportunity to say anything, if you'd like to share your feedback, input, suggestions, how you think the report might be revised or more reflective, or priorities where you think you'd like to see the expert panel focus, that would be very helpful.
Hi, Christy. You can go ahead.
Go ahead.
Christy, this is Robert Ellis.
Hey, Robert.
Hi. I would like to concur in large part with what you said. I mean, the fall has been, in many ways, a different path than where I was having read the draft report as standalone. I think as a standalone document, I think it does come off as extraordinarily provider-centric, and any patient-centric components of it kind of get lost in the mix. So some of the items that I think have been highlighted as patient-centric elements during the course of this discussion, I think whether one believes that they rise to high enough level or not to make the argument, I think those elements really get lost in the language of the report as it currently exists. So I do share your concern on that front.
This is Phil Mailer.
Yes, Phil.
From Denver Health, one of the, I think, well-regarded safety nets in the country. I actually surprisingly have a little bit of a different take. I think that the recommendations, although I see Lee's point that it is somewhat provider and less patient-centric, but I think the import of it really supports the issue of the safety net and you know, those that take care of the vulnerable and the disenfranchised populations. To me, the essence of this, which I think we all agree with, is the fact that there are disparities of care. Some of the genetic predispositions of folks that seek care at the safety nets, I think, are all irrefutable. And I think, you know, Andrew Ryan, I don't remember the exact time that he wrote the perspective piece in the New England Journal late last year, I really think emphasized this, that the initial data from the hospital value-based purchasing first-year implementation showed that hospitals that have a higher DISH index had significantly lower Medicare payment adjustments as a result of that, again speaking to the fact that these socioeconomic issues are key drivers of how very dedicated providers can deliver care, as was eloquently stated by the doctor that works in the federally qualified health centers for the last many years. I think the recommendations do speak to that, and I would only suggest that maybe we really need a more bold statement in there that for those hospitals that are true safety net institutions who will continue to take care of a large percentage of uninsured patients, even though it's gotten better with the ACA, that maybe there needs to be strong legislation, statements, et cetera, that we need payment reform for those institutions so that we don't paradoxically worsen the gaps by these value-based purchasing programs, which I think do run the risk of increasing disparities in care rather than decreasing it. But the recommendations per se, I think, speak to all the facts that these are realities that we have to deal with. I think that maybe we could have some kind of a collective statement at the end that says that in payment mechanisms, we need reforms where we're not going to damage the ability of these safety net institutions to care for the folks that we're talking about.
Thank you, Phil.
Hi, this is Dave Rue. I just wanted to say it was an excellent presentation, and what really made it very compelling for me was one of the slides you showed with the example where you had the A, B, and C, and I think what really helped me see the issues was the stratification. And this gets back to some of the comments that were made earlier, and I know we're talking about risk adjustment, but the stratification really helps us elucidate the issues. I do think that we need to look to see how we can incorporate both the stratification and risk adjustments to enable us to be able to identify these challenges and maybe look at all the different options. I just felt that for me that was the one slide that really kind of helped put things into perspective. I do also think that there's a need where, you know, these unintended consequences, even though we want to be very patient-centric, a large part of it is driven by the healthcare provider, and healthcare providers today are very sensitive to how they're ranked, and they can get very frustrated if they feel that they're not resourced to do certain things. So I don't know if the quality metrics that we apply, if there's some kind of criteria out there that allows us to be able to determine, are we applying this to individual physicians that may not be resourced, or are we applying this to organizations that may have some ability to impact things? And I just don't know if it's a one-size-fit-all for these metrics, if you apply it across the board or if you start looking at it. For those that are organizationally fit, able to apply the resources, then they can apply it down to the physician level. For those that aren't, maybe we look at some way to compare within peer groups. And so I just feel that this is such a complicated issue that if we take a simplistic approach and apply it to everybody, we might run into these challenges.
Thank you.
Christy, this is Dana. Could I make a comment?
Sure.
So, I agree with the sentiments that it would be good if time would allow to make some additions to this report to address some of the things we've talked about. And I think the two that I would highlight are, I think we're all in agreement that payment matters, and payment will change some of these results. And I think that being very explicit that models of payment, that we actually ought to be looking at the population served, the very things that we're contemplating whether to adjust for, are in fact things that would require providers to need more resources to accomplish good outcomes. And we ought to at least, address that in this report, that in order to actually close the gap on disparities, we have to deal with payment and adequate payment and incentives to providers to close the gap, not just try to deal fairly, so to speak, by adjusting away differences and making it, showing us a number of what their performance would have looked like if they didn't take care of a disadvantaged population. I think it's very important, given all that we're saying, that we address payment issues in this report. And the second is, I think we've heard a lot about looking through the patient lens and looking through the provider lens at these issues. And I think it would enhance this report to be explicit about that. That is to have a section that says, what would patients want, what would patients want to see, and what do providers want, and how are we proposing something that we think serves both, because I don't think the report really calls out the patient perspective in this in some of the very explicit ways that we've talked about. And, you might even say that what a patient might want is to see those stratified numbers, because I'm not average. If I'm a low-income patient, I don't want to see the adjusted number. I want to see how this provider does with low-income population, assuming that the sample size underneath that is adequate to be giving a real result.
Thank you, Dana. Anyone else who hasn't had a chance to talk yet?
Well, I've had a chance, but I would like to make a statement.
Well, let Andy, if it's okay.
Yes, I'll wait my turn.
let me see if there's room for others as well.
Yes.
I've got you on the list, though. Anybody else before we go back to Andy?
It's Bill. I've got the same request.
Okay.
And if you can put me on there, it's Ann.
Okay.
Christy, this is Carolyn Perry. I have one comment.
Good.
I really
known
exactly how to make it. You know, a lot of what we're proposing here is very important, but it's based on a system that exists right now that we all acknowledge has significant flaws in delivering care people need where people need that care. And I guess my aspirational hope would be that for those providers that are taking exceptional care of underserved populations, I would like to see them get greater benefit and that their exceptional service and outcomes be recognized, and so we could eventually funnel more money to those people as opposed to just risk adjusting away the disadvantaged population so that they look like everyone else.
Thank you, Carolyn. Anyone else before we go to Andy, Phil, and Ann?
I'm sorry, Dave here. Can I just make a quick comment? We will indeed pursue this idea, but since we had such a nice comment from Denver Health a while ago, I'll just speak personally for myself, I fully expect that in good adjustment models, an outstanding organization like Denver Health will emerge as even more outstanding. And this would be true of a whole class of providers who are already doing a superb job with disadvantaged populations. That would be the mathematical effect of adjustment. It would not pull these folks back to the middle. It would exaggerate their standing as outstanding. And if I'm somehow wrong on that inference, please let me know.
This is Phil Mailer again. No, I appreciate your comment. I think that it's clear that the quality delivered is fine and exceptional in many of our places, but I think the issue is, for instance, on readmissions, depending on how you get picked up from the hospital, there's a big leap of faith what's going to happen to you. And so with readmissions, if you penalize the safety nets because they're not achieving, you're just making it harder for them to achieve because they already have limited resources. The data about nurse staffing ratios, if you have a bigger ratio and more nurses, you're going to cut down on readmissions. I know Dr. Small et al. Published a paper in Health Affairs about this last year. So I agree with you. The quality will be accentuated. I just worry about some of the value-based payments and readmission penalties. I think the other thing is in patient satisfaction. As that's being looked at more and more, as you know, there's good evidence that patient satisfaction scores are correlated with higher expenditures for medical things for these patients. Well, we don't have that capacity, so there are those that believe that the safety nets will never be able to achieve the national averages with regard to patient satisfaction. So, yes, I think the quality will be accentuated. I worry about some of the disconnects with regard to some of the payments that may come out of and I would submit that maybe there needs to be a hold and a rethinking of that. And I think this document speaks to that these socioeconomic corrections are critical in order to make these decisions about payment going forward.
Thank you, Phil. I think we'll go to Ann and then to Andy, and then I think that we will move on either to public comment or the next agenda item, Helen, after Andy.
We've got to do public comment, so that's an absolute. But, yeah, let's go after the comments, yeah.
Okay, Ann?
Just very briefly, one of my concerns, and Dana stressed it, is that if the further away we get from reality in terms of the measurement, I think the less likely there's going to be support for additional dollars for the safety net. And the more the safety net, whether it's Denver Health showing up as number one on those blunted measures or whether someone shows up as number 50. I just think it's going to distort the reality of what care is like at those places and give us very little ammunition to raise more money for the safety net. So that's just my comment.
Andy?
Thank you. So, and in somewhat of a similar vein, I think, I guess my overall, this is just the whole general concept. When you look at probably the most significant argument that we're hearing and is a report has to do with concerns about, I guess the word would be misallocation of incentives, which may or may not be dollars, but certainly most commonly are dollars, and the fact that that may cause even worsening of disparities. I guess my fundamental issue is it's very disturbing to me that we would try and solve for the abuse and dysfunctional payment methodologies by changing the way we measure and report on measures, when in fact the problem is not the measure, the problem is how people are inappropriately using the measure. So to me, it just seems like we're trying to solve somebody else's mistake in what they do with these measures by adjusting the measure, and I think that we lose something in the measure by doing it, and it's really not our place to do that, because truthfully somebody will come up with another payment methodology change that we'll have to adjust to 5 years from now and say that now we're once again misallocating dollars because we are doing socio-demographic risk adjustment and we'll have to take it away. So I guess I just fundamentally have a problem with the major impetus behind the changes to correct the problem that's occurring outside of the measurement world and in the folks that control payment methodologies and incentive methodologies. Thank you.
It's Lee. May I make a follow-up?
Sure.
I actually think we can look at the opposite way. Why are we giving credit to people who have a situation in which they look great, but given their population, the expected would be much even greater? So, in other words, you're concerned about making the hospitals that may be actually a little worse better because they're safety nets. I would actually argue that this will do both sides of the equation, in that hospitals that currently are in areas that get increasing resources that just do an acceptable job, that unless I'm mistaken by the way this would work, they will not get the same degree of buy as they would currently.
That
and
is
I'm
true.
I'm curious from the people on the panel who are the methodologically oriented, do they agree that we can think of it in the opposite direction too?
No, you're absolutely correct, Dave, here, and I've been sort of hanging on that point through our whole call and just wasn't quite time to make it. No, the adjustment works both ways. There are organizations who appear to be better than they really are because of the nature of the patients they take care of, and I think we should be concerned about the current absence of pressure or incentive if we want to think in those terms on those folks. They look better on paper than they really are.
Thank you.
Christy,
thank you very much.
Conway, I just want to get the brief comment in here. You know, we just pulled together some of the nation's best authorities on disparities. They went through a lot of evidence. There's very good evidence that there should be socioeconomic adjusters, came up with what I thought was a fabulous report, and we spent a couple of hours second-guessing that excellent advice. And this is not an issue about negative intention of providers or patients versus providers. We should be looking to get to a level of optimal accuracy when we have the metrics out in the field. And our debate should be about how we should do that. If you take a lot of the discussion today and translate it to clinical, we should not have any clinical adjusters on any of our measures because we can get to the purest results that way.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of you on the CSAC for being fully engaged, which is what we wanted you to do today. And I know that we will continue to wrestle with these issues. I want to thank Dave and Kevin especially for spending the time with us today. I hope that you have felt it has been useful to you, both in terms of helping us better understand, but also perhaps hearing from us how the report may be able to be tweaked in order to be more reflective of your actual deliberations and perspectives. And I want to thank, obviously, Karen and Helen and the team at NQF for the work that they've done around this issue. Helen, should I open it up for public comment now, or what should I do?
Yes, definitely. We've got to open a public comment. I know we missed a couple of committee members, so if they're still around, feel free to get in the public comment queue. So, operator, please open the line for public comment.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Thank you.
Your first question comes from the line of Eugene Eagle.
Hi, I presume that was Eugene Nuccio. I'm a member of the expert panel, but I come at the work from the perspective of a measured developer for post-acute settings. And even though I come at it from a diametrically opposed perspective from my friend Steve, who is a provider, represents provider perspective, we also are very, very concerned about what we would call false positives. That is, identifying a provider, both to the provider and to its clientele, as being a poor provider because we've not accounted for those things that have not, that were outside of the clinical realm. And by including sociodemographic variables in the risk adjustment model, we can begin to focus the resulting the results of the analysis truly on quality of care, which is what we're trying to assess here. We're trying to assess how well different healthcare providers give care to different populations. So after risk adjusting for sociodemographics, if when you stratify the results, you still find a disparity in performance, a disparity now more closely aligned to quality of care for one of these subpopulations, then you can make a more reasonable a statement to that provider that we have accounted for both patient clinical case mix as well as those other characteristics of the patient population that are outside the control of a provider in the modeling and the risk adjustment process. And so now you as a healthcare provider need to examine how well you are in fact translating the care delivery to meet the specific needs of that patient population. So that's, I just wanted to point out that both from a provider perspective and from a clinic, from a measure developer perspective, we're very much interested in ensuring that we have no negative, false positives, that is inappropriately identifying provider B in David's example as in the same group as provider C. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. Anyone else, operator?
Yes, your next question comes from Aiken Demain.
Hi,
good afternoon. This is Akeen Demahin from the American Hospital Association, and I just want to thank the CSAC for its discussion this afternoon and really applaud the steering committee for this project for its incredibly thoughtful assessment of what is an incredibly complicated issue. And I guess I would like to echo some of what Eugene just said in his comments in terms of the issue of false positives. You know, we view the issue of socioeconomic adjustment, both of one as fairness to the providers being assessed, but also as a way to really focus providers on those aspects of care that can really be improved. We think the direction of the recommendations of the committee is really excellent, and we're definitely looking forward to reviewing them in more detail when the report is released. And certainly, You know, we certainly feel that the issue of adjustment as it relates to patients and the patient perspective on it is absolutely of critical importance. On the other hand, the failure to adjust for sociodemographic factors is currently having the effect of taking away resources providers, and because it's taking away those resources, it can really have an impact on the patients that we serve. So thank you again for this very thoughtful discussion.
Thanks, Akeem. Operator?
Again, if you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Allison Zillow.
Go ahead. Hello?
Allison, your line is open.
Hi, this is Allison Shippey from the National Partnership for Women and Families. Just want to echo the thanks to the really thoughtful discussion that everyone's been having. I typed this in the chat box, but wanted to make sure that the message came through. The panel had noted that there were three techniques or methods that they were essentially reviewing: the adjustment, stratification, and peer grouping. But we only saw a table for the adjustment, and I really thought this was a really helpful illustration. I'm curious if the panel would consider providing illustrations for both the peer grouping and the stratification method. Might provide a lot of context as we're reviewing the report. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dr.
Sure. Easy to do that.
Great.
Yep.
Any further questions or comments at this time?
Great.
Can you hear, this is Susanna Bernheim. I've been trying to get through. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Hi, Susanna. Finally, we couldn't hear you. Sorry. Go ahead.
I pressed star 1 about 4 times. I spoke when you called my name. I started to think it was a conspiracy. I will be brief. I am also one of the committee members, and I want to thank the chairs and the committee because this has been a heroic amount of work, and I think people have really tried to build consensus. But I do want to say that I want the CSEC to know that I think that the way that the recommendations were presented today didn't reflect all of the nuance of the committee's discussion, and I really appreciate some of the important questions that were asked by Dana and Christy and Anne and others. A number of us have also concerns about the way these recommendations will be implemented and perceived. I think there's no question that the committee felt there is a need to change the current NQF guidance, which is no risk adjustment for SES. There are certainly cases where that needs to happen, but there are pros and cons. I think there are real issues around what we want to set as a standard for care for low-income populations, and that has to be considered carefully on a measure-by-measure basis, and I encourage the CSEC to continue to ask some of these hard questions and help our committee build recommendations that are we can implement and which will balance both provider and patient perspectives in the use of the measures. I think that the current payment policy is driving these recommendations too strongly, and we need to continue to balance questions of how we best assess quality and incentivize care for low-income populations with very legitimate concerns that I share about the impact on safety net providers of current payment policies. So, thank you.
Thanks, Dan. All right, Christy.
Okay.
We're running out of time.
I think we are, and I apologize, but I think it was important to kind of focus on this issue. Do you want to even begin to tee up, or I know we only have about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is just so the CSAC knows, and thank you. Obviously, this has been a remarkable discussion, and we really appreciate certainly Kevin and Dave's time and patience through this process. I have truly never seen more dedicated chairs in my tenure at NQF, so much appreciated. At this point, we actually will have a debrief with the chairs, and we'll figure out what we can do in terms of what may require modification prior to public comment. But we also don't want to lose sight of the fact that, you know, public comment is a really powerful piece of the NQF process. So we'll do what we can to, you know, see if there's some issues we can address, additional examples, et cetera, reframing. But, you know, I think we don't want to also lose sight of the fact that that is a really important part of our process, and we want to try to get that out in a timely way, meet our deliverables, of course. But really appreciate the time here. We did skip over our levels of endorsement discussion, which we thought fit nicely given how much of the discussion was actually about measures fit for purpose and how you would use them and adjustment, et cetera. So I think we'll try to tee that up tomorrow as part of part two of our CSAC extended webinars, where we'll be talking about the preliminary thinking around criteria for the episode groupers. So you have the slides on your SharePoint. You'll see the last couple slides for today. We're actually teeing up some questions Karen Pace and I had drafted to kind of think through how we might move forward doing measures, levels of endorsement for measures. But I think we'll return to that tomorrow, Christy. So I will leave the last word to you and any final comments from anyone else.
Well, thank you very much. And like I said earlier, I want to thank everybody on the call for their participation today. Our call tomorrow is at 3 o'clock Central. 3 o'clock Eastern time, 2 o'clock Central. and thank you very much, Helen, for being willing to kind of move that second item from today's agenda over to tomorrow.
It's too good a discussion to cut off.
I agree. Well, thank you all very much, and we look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.